So I just wanted to thank Ratnaprabha because his agreeing to do the study was quite last minute, actually. So being the sort of man he is, he agreed, which is wonderful. Again, I sort of, it's a bit presumptuous, but I sort of feel I know Ratnaprabha without actually spending much time with him. Again, as with a lot of order members. But personally, I just think of him as the living, breathing exemplar of being a good man. I don't mean good man in the general sense. In fact, Bhante, I remember Bhante saying, yes, he's a good man, in the Bhante sense. You know, when he said a good man, he, you know, had certain weight to it. I think I must have read your book at the time we were discussing it. Finding the Mind, yeah. Probably off the back of that. But, yeah, I think listening to Subhadramati yesterday, it struck me that if you want to get to know somebody, read their books or book. And I did feel I got to know Ratnaprabha. That wonderful blend of clarity and feeling, actually. Quite a lot of strong feeling in there. There was a line, wasn't there? I was just talking to Lokabandhu in the puja last night. The glorying of... the bliss of glorying in one's own clear mind. So I think that combination of clarity and deep feeling is quite rare, so it makes them very readable, but you also get a sense of Ratnaprabha, freeing the mind. I'm afraid I didn't actually find my mind, but that's just me.
In that case, you understood the book. Thank you very much. Yes, it was very, very nice to be offered this chance to talk on this topic, particularly lineage and the lineages is not really something I'd looked into or thought about. And I haven't been able to do so all that thoroughly either. But the fortunate thing is that this is really an introduction to doing some study on Bhante's lecture, authority and the individual in the new society. And so we can do the clarifying ourselves, and I'm sure that, you know, each of us has got something to contribute in thinking about the areas and how that connects with the four lineages. And that, again, wasn't obvious to me at first. I tried to work out, why have they chosen this particular lecture? Why not some basic exposition of the four lineages? But I think the reason probably is that in a way the lecture introduces particularly aspects of the lineage of responsibility, and it's to do with the opening of Sukhavati and Bhante explaining what Sukhavati and the LBC and therefore a true Ratna Center, what they were about. And of course, as presidents, that seems to me to be presumably very important to us. To get to grips with that. Yes, so lineage isn't something I'd ever really looked into, but it is very important in British tradition. So if we think back even to the time of the Buddha himself, when he encounters his own father a year after the Enlightenment, if you remember, what happens is that he's doing his normal alms round, dressed in mud-stained robes, just walking around, receiving food from the poorest people in the town. And his father says, this is not the custom of our lineage, this is not the custom of our tribe, of our status in society. He's very shocked by this. And the Buddha replies by saying, well, it is the custom of my lineage, effectively. In other words, the lineage of the Buddhas, or of great arahants and so on. So there's already that sense in early Buddhism of a succession of Buddhas, and they're even named the seven Buddhas of the present Kalpa, I think I seem to remember something like that, at various stages, and whatever historicity that has, the Buddha does seem to have had a genuine sense that he was not the first. However, of course, it was a fractured lineage, as we say, in the sense that the teachings of those previous Buddhas had not survived, which is why we needed another Buddha. So when the Buddha set up his movement, He was very careful to make sure that the lineages were not fractured. He was very careful to make sure that his teachings were passed on, the practices he was teaching were passed on, and presumably also the inspiration was passed on, in the sense that it can be passed on. The insight that he gained, he wanted to make sure that others received that. And so in the early years of Buddhism, in the Hinayana schools, you will get each school legitimizing itself by referring to its founder and even by listing the monks that passed down that tradition, usually monks as far as I know, and going right back to the immediate disciples of the Buddha himself, and they'll specify who that is. And then we get Buddhism going, spreading around the rest of Asia. And when it goes into China and the Chinese, you know, general cultural milieu, we've there got a really strong interest in ancestry. And so the lineage in the Buddhist schools combines with this interest in you know, who are the parents, who are the ancestors of our school. And so there's a very strong sense they want to be sure who these people were, what they taught, how it was transmitted, their biographies and so on. And so you'll get these long lists in the Huayan school, you'll get it in the Tiantai school, going right back, again, going right back to the immediate disciples of the Buddha and the Buddha himself. And of course we're probably familiar with the case of Zen, where the transmission goes back to the Buddha holding up a golden flower, Mahakashyapa being the one who realized that. He transmits that to Ananda, Ananda transmits that to his disciple, and it's transmitted, in this case, wordlessly. With the Huayan school and the Tiantai school, we're talking about transmission through the Avatamsaka Sutra and the White Lotus Sutra in particular, but in Zen, it's explicitly said it's not a transmission through words and letters. It's something that goes directly from master to disciple. So the lineages in traditional Buddhism are very definitely lineages of people, and not just any old people, but very definitely named people. And presumably we can't take this all that literally. They all do tend to go back to Ananda and the Buddha, and very often Mahakashyapa, and some one or two other very early post-Buddha teachers. All these lineages in East Asian Buddhism go back to them. But you know, well, you can take it how you like, can't you? And then you get further traditions and stories, and in particular, again, the one we're particularly familiar with, I guess, is the transmission to Huineng, in which we talk about the 6th and 7th patriarchs of Chan in China. And this does seem to be a, you know, a story that, at least aspects of it are a story that are made up later, in a way to legitimize the dominant forms of Zen and Chan in China and Japan. But what's being transmitted? And here we've got this phrase, the transmission of the lamp. There's a text called The Transmission of the Lamp, and there's that feeling, which I think probably is an image that goes back to the Buddha himself, of one candle or one light lighting another without its own flame being in any way diminished. And in fact, that one flame can light many flames as time goes on. And then we've got Tibetan Buddhism. And in Tibetan Buddhism, we've got a concern over the authenticity of the teacher and the transmission of Vajrayana empowerments and so on. And I don't know very much about that area. But again, we have definite lineages of people. And so on the refuge trees of the different schools of Tibetan Buddhism, you'll get carefully identified figures representing the succession, the lineage, how this school was founded, for example, with Nyingma, founded by Padmasambhava. But then not just Padmasambhava, but other figures, non-historical figures, who transmitted their teachings to Padmasambhava, mythical figures, transcendental figures. And in the case of the Golub school, you'll have Tsongkhapa, right there in the centre of the refuge tree. And in our refuge tree, of course, we also have that. We have the historical Buddha and his disciples. We have non-historical figures like Maitreya and Dipankara and the and some of the Bodhisattvas and so on. And we also have Bhante and his eight teachers there on the refuge tree. So how authentic is our lineage? So Bhante was careful not to slot us into a particular Asian Buddhist tradition. I know you all know this, but I hope you don't mind me just sort of enunciating this sort of thing. And he didn't want to claim to be authorized from within a tradition to transmit that tradition to the West. A transmission from particular masters to him as a master, transmitting to the West. And that might be something we could discuss. Why did he decide to do that? Maybe it's obvious, but why did he decide not to bring over the traditions he'd been given in a way, particularly from his Tibetan teachers? But six of his eight main teachers were Tibetan lamas, and with some of them he does talk about the approval, the encouragement that he was given for his work in the West. So we do have something a little bit less traditional, a little bit less formal, let's say, but we do have an identification of a sort of a lineage going on there, something being passed to Bhante by his teachers, but also something being passed to Bhante from another dimension, as they say, what people call the superpersonal force, and Bhante's experience of Amitabha, Bhante's experience when he was giving his lectures after Ambedkar's death, and the sense also that he felt that the order was being founded by something that was, you know, passing through him rather than coming from him, and so on. So on the one hand, he didn't want to be associated with a particular lineage, but he was also criticised for lacking legitimacy for that reason. So we did get particularly people associated, I think, with Tibetan and Buddhism, or maybe Zen as well. You know, what is your school? Where are you coming from? Are you legitimate? Is this Lingwoodism or something? So in the old days, we didn't often talk about lineage, I think, in Sri Ratna. At least I don't remember talking about it very much, except to be a little bit disparaging, perhaps, of Westerners' obsession with finding authenticated Asian teachers, and maybe being a little bit disparaging of the tulku system in Tibetan Buddhism as well. And indeed, even as a monk, Bhante had questioned the legitimacy of his own ordination, because he felt that some of those present were not true monks in the sense of the legitimacy of their ordinations and so on, and that going back, and maybe this applies, he felt, to nearly all of the Theravadin monks, that their ordinations were not fully valid. So then it'd be difficult to find out when this was, but there was a question and answer session with the public preceptors and Bhante. And I think it was probably in 2007, because Dhammarati referred to it in a talk that he gave at an order weekend in March 2008, which I got notes from. So, I haven't been able to track all this stuff down, but given more time I might have done, but maybe it doesn't matter all that much. So at this question and answer session with the public preceptors, Parami asked Bhante a question about transmission during ordination. And as sometimes happens with Bhante, he came up with a new list, a new system, and so on, in answer to that question. And this is something that he called at the time the threefold lineage. I'd like to thank Dhammarati very much for sending me the transcript of that and some other material as well. And I also just want to thank Lokabandha as well for giving me some really useful tips and leads. So this threefold lineage, he said, was teaching, practice, and inspiration. So the teaching is the FWBO approach to the Dharma, mainly his approach to the Dharma. Practice is the practice that he's taught, and he also says also emphases given by certain leading order members. Inspiration, something communicated personally in addition to communicating actual teachings or actual practices, something else mysterious communicated personally, especially at the private ordination, as though something is transmitted, is the way he phrases it there. And he also has an afterthought at the end of this, and he says, well, there's also another lineage, which he calls the organisational lineage, the framework or structure to be carried on and to be modified as necessary. And so then this number four nowadays is referred to as the lineage of responsibility, and it seems to have gone through another metamorphosis in between where it was called lineage of institutions. This is probably all Subhuti's doing. So Subhuti wanted to expound the lineages, and so as he does, he systematised it, thought it through, maybe talked about it more with Bhante. There may well be other sources from Bhante, but this is the only source I've found from Bhante, is the one where he talks to Parami at this question and answer session. After that, other people have referred to it. Parami herself gave a talk on the lineage of inspiration as part of a series by women preceptors, I think, to the order. Padmavajra has given talks on the lineages, and Subhuti is referred to quite often as well, I think. And no doubt others have as well that I'm not aware of. So when Subhuti, for example, articulated the vision of Adhisthana, which I suppose would have been around 2013 or something like that, he says, a secondary meaning of the word Adhisthana is that it can mean an authoritative position in the sense of a seat of government, power or authority. That's the Sanskrit word Adhisthana. And he says, while our Adhisthana cannot be conceived in quite these terms, nonetheless it will be the seat of leadership and of the principal unifying forces in the Tri Ratna order and the community worldwide. He also talks a bit later about guiding forces. So especially, of course, it's to be the seat of the public preceptors and also will be used by others taking major responsibilities in Tri Ratna. And he also said there should be, in this vision of Adhisthana, there should be training for order members at Adhisthana, training to take responsibility in the order and the movement. So I don't know, we can talk about this, I don't know if there's any shift in meaning from Bhante's original, an organisational lineage or a lineage of structures to a lineage of the institutions of the movement to a lineage of responsibility. You know, Dharmarati suggested maybe the lineage refers to the institutions themselves. I don't know if I understood you rightly, but I guess lineages in general do seem to be people, really. So it does seem to me a little bit easier to handle, in one's mind at least, if you see it as a lineage of responsibility in the sense of passing on, actual real people passing on responsibilities, like passing on the presidency of your centre, like passing on the chairship of a centre, like passing on the head of the college, chair of the college, that is, you know, these are all lineages in a way, aren't they? In the case of, say, preceptors, it's a little more complex because Bhante passed on to a lot of public preceptors, and that's been passed on to a lot of private preceptors. So you definitely don't get a one-to-one transmission there, do you? But then you don't in traditional Buddhism either. Very often it branches. So Hui Neng, for example, He's the last new numbered patriarch in Zen, as far as I know, and I think the reason for that is that he had 43 recognised enlightened disciples. And then maybe he's got a bit too many for people to remember them all, and then presumably they all had their own successors. Mm. And so you don't necessarily get it as a one-to-one thing. Yes, so maybe we could question that idea that a lineage has to be passed down through a succession of people, and teachings, practices, even inspiration, they can be passed down through other means, can't they? So maybe we could introduce this as a question. How are inspiration and responsibility in particular passed on? I say that just because those are the two lineages that we're concentrating on this week. How are those lineages passed on in your experience and in your ideals? Okay, so our our topic of the study is this lecture that Bhante gave in 1979, Authority and the Individual in the New Society. And so if you haven't already looked at the lecture or listened to it, it's on Free Buddhist Audio, and the transcript is also on Free Buddhist Audio, and it's lecture number 137. And I think the reason we're looking at this is because it represents maybe an idealistic or a principle-based view of some aspects of the lineage of responsibility, especially. So that's in a way what the lecture is introducing. And it's an early introduction of that. It's only 10 years or so after the founding of the order. So how do you apply the pristine ideals of the spiritual community acting as the nucleus of a new society consisting of true individuals in which there is no place at all for power, authority and representation? How do you apply these principles to the real task of being a president or being a chair? So that's enormously rewarding and fun to think about that.
Those
yes, I will. I'm going to give you a handout, which has got a summary of the talk, which is there. But I will repeat them though now, because it seems to me that they are those really familiar phrases from the old days of the movement, aren't they? That Bhante went on and on about in many, many lectures, which became, you know, the terminology of this movement or aspects of it, the spiritual community, and the spiritual community as which is the order. In our case, acting as the nucleus of a new society, consisting of true individuals. And I will mention here that it's clear in this lecture by a true individual, Bhante does mean anyone who is, as he would later say, effectively going for refuge. In other contexts, his term true individual appears to mean somebody who's definitely a member of the Arya Sangha. In other words, who's going for refuge is real. But in this context, he's assuming that order members are true individuals. And I suspect that he may have intimated that not all order members were members of the Arya Sangha.
Who was in the front row when he did that?
So Bhante gave this lecture in 1979, and it was at the opening celebrations of the London Buddhist Centre. And he still called it, as it was called for quite a long time, people sort of merged the word Sukhavati, which later was, and nowadays is the community above the centre, one of the men's communities in the area. But the word Sukhavati was used for the whole project, I think, in those days, wasn't it? And for some years, the Sukhavati community had consisted of builders, people turning the burnt-out fire station into a beautiful Buddhist centre. And so at this occasion, Bhante wanted to inspire his audience by revealing a transition from Sukhavati as a residential community to Sukhavati as a pure land. So he revived or reminded us of what Sukhavati means, or at least something aspiring to be like Amitabha's mythical, traditional, pure land of Sukhavati, as much as it could be. And so I think his central point in the lecture is explaining what a Triratna Buddhist centre is and what it's for, and how it must have at its heart a living spiritual community of what he called true individuals. And also going into what that implied for the way people need to relate to each other in that system. So I think I'll give you the handout now. I know it's a dangerous thing to do because you tend to read ahead, but it does mean that rather than having to take notes, you can see that I've got a summary on there. And I'll just go through that summary now. Is that okay so far? And then what I'll do at the end is I've got some suggested questions for our groups. And we've got this morning and tomorrow morning for these groups. And I don't think tomorrow morning is going to need any introduction. So that gives us quite a long time. There's loads of material potentially in those questions. I'm sure you'll have a lot of your own things to talk about as well. So I don't feel concerned about having so much time to talk about it all. So I've summarised the lecture here, and there are some bits of the lecture that I've summarised very, very succinctly. For example, there's a fairly long section on religion and how theistic religion tends to be inevitably bound up with power. So it's quite an interesting section, but it's probably not directly relevant to what we're doing here. And at first I thought, oh, all the initial stuff about Sakavati and that situation, we can skip immediately on to the issues of authority and power and so on. But then I thought, no, actually, that's really crucial. That is why he's talking about it. He's talking about it in this context of the founding of the LBC and everything that happened there. And that seems to me to be important. So I have included that in the summary. So a centre is the nucleus of a new society. It's not just for evening classes or therapeutic meditation, but it's a society providing facilities, opportunities, and a context of fellowship that encourages people to develop as human beings, instead of having to keep at bay the oppressive, coercive, crushing influence that the old society exerts upon us. So he's definitely got this very strong contrast, in a way, between what he regards as the difficulty of living in ordinary society and the necessity of creating a complete context, like a Pure Land, in which things are as conducive as possible to spiritual growth. The reason the centre can act as this nucleus as of a new society is because at its heart there's a spiritual community. So the nucleus of the new society, you can see it either as being the centre, but you also the centre must have at its heart a living spiritual community. So that's the nucleus of them. They're both the nucleus of the new society, I think, if I've understood it right. And then a spiritual community, what is that? It consists of individuals. And he clarifies, he means true individuals. Because later he talks about statistical individuals. True individuals are truly human, self-conscious, self-aware, emotionally positive, free-flowing energies, accepting responsibility for life and growth, and seeing growth as the most important thing for everybody. And this is this definition of the true individual. I remember right through the 80s, he kept on adding.
Grew and grew, yeah.
So for example, when he gave the lecture on fidelity, he would say, yes, fidelity is a characteristic of the true individual. And so, yeah, the list of characteristics grew. May have already grown by this point, I'm not sure. It's not the first time he was talking about it. And traditionally, the true individual is those who commit themselves to the three jewels, or go for refuge to the three jewels. And the spiritual community at the London Buddhist Centre is a segment of the order, which is itself a segment of the Sangha of the three directions, the four directions, and the three periods of time. And its function is to create for itself and others conditions more conducive to human development. And here he goes into what we later call the three C's. So what does it do? The function of the spiritual community is to do these three things. Form a residential community, which is already there in the case of Sakavati. Provide opportunities for cooperative right means of livelihood. And provide classes in meditation, Buddhism, etc. And the etc., he mentions communication exercises, but also yoga classes and all the other things that you do at the centre. And then he says these correspond to three important things in ordinary life, which on balance are not conducive to spiritual development, namely the family, work, and leisure. So we might want to... Our hackles may rise, but my family's not like that, and so on. And I'm sure that's always worth going into, isn't it? But I always feel... it's always worth just trying, well, what's he actually talking about here? Okay, he may be being a little bit scathing about conventional institutions in society, but he has some reason for doing so, and we can take that on balance. So the family, claustrophobic, neurotic, nuclear. I remember when I first went along to the Brighton Buddhist Centre, I was wearing a badge. And it was a badge. And it was based on the CND badges at the time, which said, nuclear power, no thanks. And my little badge, which I don't know, picked up at college, said, nuclear family, no thanks. And I was already, you know, living communally at that time, and my father was actually a founder of the Community Living Association in London, so communities were already a really big part of my understanding. And I also, you know, given the disaster of my parents' marriage, I already had a very cynical view of the nuclear family. And then ordinary work, wage slavery, earning in ways harmful to your own development, exploiting other people. And then ordinary leisure activities, which you just do to pass the time, to forget about your family, your work, and to forget about yourself. So the centre is the bridge from the nucleus of the new society, that is the spiritual community, to the old society. It's where the two meet and overlap. So I don't. If we've forgotten about that idea, it's quite a nice idea to think about your own centre in that way. It's a bridge. You know, how thriving is the spiritual community? How thriving is the bridge? How thriving is the connection between that spiritual community and the whole of the rest of society, at least locally? Someone who attends the centre may eventually decide to go forth. So he gives a little story here of somebody attending and different things that happen. From family or work into a spiritual community or a right livelihood project. Now they're part of the new society. One's strength as an individual goes to strengthen that new society, and one lives all the time in a situation which is conducive to one's development. And then he goes, that's, you know, talking about Sakavati, so it is important, isn't it, that stuff? And then he goes into authority, power and representation. So statistical individuals, as opposed to true individuals, possess group consciousness. Their thought, feeling and behaviour conforms to group patterns and norms. But also, what are the principles that govern the spiritual community, as opposed to those that govern the group, especially in the sphere of power? So he's got various definitions in here. Authority is power that comes from one's position, one's recognised office, as it were. A representative is entrusted with the power of the group and exercises its power because of his position. And so in that capacity, can't be treated as a true individual. But a spiritual community is only a spiritual community if those in it are treated as individuals. So you can't have representing in the spiritual community. You can't have offices, you can't have positions, you can't have authority. And obviously we do have offices and positions in both the order and the movement, so we can talk about a little bit about that. Is that a degeneration? Is it just that, you know, Banti is talking rather principially here, and the offices and positions have a different meaning than they would in society as a whole? There can be no authority in the new society in any of the three C's, although in a centre there may be exceptions. But there's only authority where one has to deal with people who are not yet true individuals, since the centre is the bridge from the group to the spiritual community. So he actually says, well, in a right livelihood cooperative, who is it who employs whom? And in the early days, they were very, I think they did tend to be very team-based, didn't they, the co-ops, you know, without hierarchy. But now it's not necessarily like that, and I think that the few right livelihood co-ops we have very often do have a manager. And also employment law means somebody has to be employing somebody, and same goes, and one of the questions I've given is, you know, looking at a centre, how many ways there are in which, in a way you don't have much choice but to exercise power and authority, because you're a legal charity and there are things you've got to do. So power is defined here as the possession of a controlling influence over others, the capacity to exert force or to coerce. And this can be direct or indirect, physical or psychological, but it can't be spiritual. And the word power, as in the other words here, they do have other meanings, but he's defining them in a particular way. So this is interesting, isn't it? The sense of to what extent is one exercising power, even within the order. Kilometra is giving his account of his experience of Bhante on that Sweden retreat, and that, you know, at least from one side at least, looks like an exercise of power, even coercion. So, you know, to what extent is that going on? Is it that there is maybe, in a way, unconsciously power and coercion being used in different circumstances, and what can we do about that if that is the case? Representing an authority both involve exerting power, so there's no place for power, i.e. the capacity to coerce, in the spiritual community. But there is a place for power in the group, which needs it. So the whole of politics is about who is coercing whom. And group members relate to each other in terms of power. Presumably that's not entirely true. I mean, there are other ways they relate, but anyway, maybe that by definition in a sense. But treating others through power in the spiritual community means it ceases to be a spiritual community for you, as you're not treating the others as true individuals. And then there's the section on religion, theistic religions. And then he finishes the lecture by looking at the bodhicitta as the spiritual of, as the principle of the spiritual community. So power is the principle governing the group. What is the principle that governs the spiritual community? And first of all, he says it's metta, it's the other positive emotions, because friendliness to others is the same thing as seeing them as individuals. Or better, to include a metaphysical or a transcendental element, as he puts it, not just metta, but maha metta, maha maitri, or maha karuna, metta conjoined with wisdom. Or best of all, the principle that governs the spiritual community is the bodhicitta, reflected in the hearts and minds of its members. Imagine a community imbued with or governed by the bodhicitta. We're used to functioning in groups relating through power. Instead, learn to relate through metta and the other positive emotions, and on the basis of the bodhicitta, which is immanent in all. Relate to one another as individuals in terms of that transcendental compassion come wisdom basis. Going for refuge means moving from the group to the spiritual community. That is, it means moving from the power principle to the bodhicitta. And I guess it may be that at that stage in 79, Bhante hadn't started talking about love mode and power mode, but very soon afterwards, well, in the Ten Pillars lecture, which is from 1984,
He first brought that in on my ordination retreat, which was in 1980.
1980, okay, yeah. Love mode and power mode, yeah, so not long after this. So then he finishes the lecture by going through the Amitāya Dhyāna Sutra and the story of Queen Vaidehi, which I expect you're familiar with. We all aspire for a better world. The Buddha teaches Vaidehi to meditate on Amitāyas and the pure land of Sukhavati, where everything conduces to attaining enlightenment. So Vaidehi was imprisoned by her own son, Ajātasatru. As you probably know, and her husband was effectively murdered. King Bimbisara was murdered by Jatasattva, and she, in anguish, calls on the Buddha to say, you know, what a horrible world this is. Isn't there a better place? And he shows her Sukhavati in the sutra. And this may seem remote. This is still summarising Bhante's lecture. But we have to create it here on earth by improving conditions as much as we can. Hence, our embryonic Sukhavati is the nucleus of the new society. With no representing, no authority, no power, the bodhicitta reigns, and individuals in free association create a society governed by Maha Maitri and Maha Karuna, inspired by wisdom and the bodhicitta. So that's... I'm sure I haven't done full justice to the lecture. It's quite a long lecture, but I think it would be very difficult to bring it to the study groups and do it paragraph by paragraph. You probably would only get half a page through it, I expect. So I thought it might be helpful to have a bit of a summary of the points that I thought were particularly relevant to us as presidents. So if you look at the end of that handout, there are some suggested questions. So we've got this threefold lineage of teachings, practice and inspiration with organisation or institutions or responsibility added. How are inspiration and responsibility passed on in Tri Ratna? In what way is there a lineage involving the Tri Ratna Centre and office bearers like the chair or the president? Is it still a basic task of the spiritual community to create the three C's? Some of these questions were, I didn't actually copy them out, but Lokabandhu suggested some questions which I've incorporated here. What's the basis of your influence at the centre of which you're president? What power or authority do you have there? Under what circumstances does power have to be exercised at a Tri Ratna centre, and over whom? So here I thought about, I haven't put it down here, but I thought, you know, about relating the centre to the authorities, to the government, the local governments and so on. That's a potentially power relation, isn't it? To maybe to the neighbours, maybe to those attending the centre, maybe to those teaching at the centre, maybe to the centre team and any other employees. What does it mean to be employed by your centre? How can you reduce the element of power present in that, but yet safeguard the centre by ensuring it's still there in a way? Freelance people, such as yoga teachers, how do you relate to them? What about the council governing the charity? What power relations are involved in that? What about the process of hiring and firing people? I'm sure, you know, probably we've all had various difficult experiences in that, or at least know of them. What about the safeguarding process? That's very live at the moment, isn't it? To what extent are we, say, banning people from a centre for the sake of safeguarding, or even restricting people from being ordained for the sake of safeguarding? What about teaching relationships? Relationships between teachers and their and the people they're teaching in a centre, what processes need to be in place for protection, and that whole area of protection, you know, protecting people, safeguarding people, looking after people, also presumably involves potentially preventing others from doing what they want. What about protecting assets? What about the security of the centre and so on? And then as well as the centre, you've got any communities, any right livelihood businesses as well, which I don't know whether as presidents we think of those as being part of our responsibility, if that's the right word, but I guess in a way they are. If your local centre has businesses and communities associated with it, then I guess as a president we do need to take an interest in those. Then there's the her area of representing. Do you represent your centre, the president's meeting, or elsewhere? Are there circumstances where other people represent your centre or represent the order at the centre? So those five, I think, are all relevant to being a president. I've added another three in case you want to go into them in more general terms. They're more relevant maybe to being to the order and so on. Would it be possible never to use power, coercion or authority within the order, seen as a spiritual community? What about ordination? What about expulsion? Do the offices in the order and movement involve power? How do breaches of the love mode happen? Have Bhante and other leaders used forms of coercion at times? Have you used forms of coercion at times? And is that okay? Is Bhante unfair in characterising group members as relating through power and describing the old society as oppressive, coercive, crushing, and the family work and ledger as not conducive to spiritual development and so on? And then finally, maybe the most important question of all, what do we need to do to create a new society with no representing, inspired by wisdom and the bodhicitta? That's the quote. So I hope that's a good introduction to the study, effective introduction, gives you enough to be thinking about. I don't know, there might be any quick points of clarification while we have the group, and I guess then we'll have a tea break and go off to our groups.
Very good summary.
Yeah. 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 Thank you. Yeah.